started. Okay, so today's topic was going to be the 10 most common Hilchos Pesach Shailas that rabbis get. I think I'm going to have to break this into two different shiurim, though, because after putting together what I thought were the 10 most common Hilchos Pesach Shailas that rabbis get, I emailed Rabbi Taubes. I said, oh, by the way, I'm giving a shiur today on 10 most common Hilchos Pesach Shailas that rabbis get. Any ideas of which Shailas I should talk about? And he immediately sent me 10 Shailas, none of which were on my list. So, but I realized the Shailas that he sent me were also Shailas that I gave a lot. But then I realized we were thinking about different things. He was thinking about questions that people ask, which are very common questions that people ask, like, how do I kasher my sink? I don't think that's a shaila. It's just something you need to know how to do every single year. So there, when I was thinking of shailas, I was thinking of things that have like a little bit of, you know, that you need to, it's not just, you know, maramakumulo to say, oh, well, it says in Shulchan Aruch, this is what you're supposed to do, but something that may involve a little bit of thought, a little bit of analysis that comes up not universally to everybody every year. So maybe we'll break it into two parts. Maybe today we'll do 10 most common Hilchos Pesach Shailas that rabbis get, and tomorrow 10 most common Hilchos Pesach questions that rabbis get, because I think both are important. You need to know what the many of you are going to be rabbis, and even those who are not, you still have a chiv in Talmud Torah. So it's important to know like what the questions are that people ask, what people need to know. So one question that comes up very, very commonly in our day and age is people want to know about bedikas chametz if they're going to a hotel for Pesach. A lot of people go away for Pesach, they go to hotels. There are those that leave before the night of bedikas chametz. There are those that leave on Erev Pesach, depending whether they're going locally or they can afford to go to a warm climate, whatever the differences are. So the shaila is, do you do bedikas chametz at home, and do you do bedikas chametz at the hotel with a bracha, without a bracha? So what exactly is one supposed to do? So when it comes to doing bedikas chametz at home, so we know the Gemara tells us in the first paragraph of Pesachim that if you leave your house 30 days, within 30 days of Pesach, you got to do bedikas chametz, even if you're not going to be home for Pesach. That's what the Shulchan Aruch paskens in Tav Lamed Vav Se'if Aleph, and the Magen Avraham over there writes that in the case of doing an early bedika, the bedika should still be done with a candlelight, or for us, let's say, a flashlight, on the final night before you leave, on the last night before you head out for your trip. If you're very busy preparing, the Kaf HaChaim writes, if you're too busy preparing on that night before you leave, and you're not going to have any time that night to do bedikas chametz, do it the night before. That person is supposed to do bedikas chametz at night, the Gemara tells us in the first paragraph of Masechet Pesachim, because you're supposed to use a candle, and with a candle you're able to see more clearly, you're able to focus more clearly, as opposed to if you have just broad daylight, you're not going to be able to focus on each little corner as you would with a smaller light that's more focused on a particular area. And this would have all of the normal halachas of bedikas chametz, which would mean that just like you're not supposed to have a major meal before doing bedikas chametz on the night of bedikas chametz, because it will distract you from doing the bedika, you shouldn't have a major meal on the night of the bedika that you're going to do before doing the bedika. It happens to be that Shkia is pretty late this year, so you could probably eat dinner, you know, before Samuch, Samuch to Laila. You could eat dinner at 6 p.m. and you'll be fine. You'll be finished by 6:30, and Shkia is not till whatever 7:25, 7:30, or something like that. So you'll be able to eat. But if a person is doing bedika, it should be done at that time with all of those normal rules. When you finish the bedika, you do bittul, just like you would with a regular bedikas chametz. Then you do another bittul on Erev Pesach itself, just like you would with the regular bedikas chametz. The Ramah in Taf Lamed Vav Sif Aleph paskins that the bracha is not recited when you do bedikas chametz early. That you do bedika without a bracha. Now, generally speaking, Rav Soloveitchik had this yesod, which seems to be very, very true, that whenever we take away a birchus mitzvah, people tend to ignore the mitzvah, right? What's the halacha if a person forgets a night of Sfira and doesn't make it up the next day? So the halacha is, you continue to count without a bracha. What do most people do? they just stop counting, right? There is a halacha that on Shmini Atzeres, a person is obligated to, the Gemara says explicitly, to sit in the sukkah without a bracha. What do most people do? They just don't sit in the sukkah, right? So when we take away a birch mitzvah, people tend to start ignoring the mitzvah. So one must be wary of that and not and be careful not to ignore the mitzvah of bedikas chametz when you have the mitzvah to do. You should do the mitzvah even without the bracha. The reason we don't say the bracha, according to the Ramah, is because the nusach of the bracha, al biur chametz, implies that it's going to be juxtaposed, or at least part of the process of destroying the chametz. But if it's like a week before Pesach, it's not really part of that process. It's not really close enough to that process. It's not an ongoing process from one night to the next morning. It has this large gap in between, and therefore would not be appropriate to say the bracha according to the Ramah. Now, it's interesting, the Bir Halacha in Dibra Maschil V'lo Yivarech quotes Machlokas HaPoskim, whether we paskin like the Ramah or not, and the Bir Halacha leaves it as a tzarchi, and he's not sure whether we paskin like the Ramah on that issue. However, the standard poskim, the Alter Rebbe and Shulchan Aruch Harav and the Aruch HaShulchan say like the Ramah, and we normally assume like the Ramah, and certainly Savik Brachos Lahakel, so we assume like the Ramah that we do not say a bracha when you do Bedika a little bit early. Now, there is a way that one could potentially avoid the Chiyuv Bedika, and that is if there is something called Mechiras Yud Gimel. There are people that arrange for a separate sale of chametz on the day before Erev Pesach, and that way when the Zman Bedika hits, when the time for the Chiyuv Bedikas chametz comes, it's not your property anymore, and therefore you don't have any responsibility to do Bedikas chametz. So if at the time of the Chiyuv Bedika, which is going to be on the night before Erev Pesach, it's already the Nachri's property, then you wouldn't have the obligation of Bedikas chametz. So one can do that, and then won't have the mitzvah of Bedikas chametz. Every rabbi has the option of doing Mechiras Yud Gimel, because every rabbi has to take care of people who are going to be in different time zones. So people are going to be in Arizona or Los Angeles or Rachmanis on Hawaii, or they'll be in Lahavdil Ben Kodeshchol, they'll be in Eretz Yisrael, or the people will be in different places. So you want to make sure there is a machlok saposkim. There's a discussion in the poskim when the the Zman of the Yisr begins. Is it based on where the owner of the chametz is or where the chametz is? And therefore, we just try to be machmir. When people are in different time zones, we sell their chametz earlier, we buy it back later. They're not going to be anywhere near their chametz anyway, because if they're in different time zone, it's going to take them a while to get there, and it's going to take them a while to get back. So we sell their chametz earlier and buy it back later, and therefore they don't have to worry about it. So that part, that mechiras yud gimel, could be offered for anybody who's not going to be around on the night of bedikas chametz, and therefore they'll avoid the chiyuv bedikas. However, there are many people that don't want to avoid the Chiyuv Bedika. They would love to do the mitzvah Bedikas Chametz. They also don't want to clean up their house. They also, don't want to have to get rid of all of the chametz in their house. So then we came up with a trick. And the trick that we have is in the standard forms of Bedikas Chametz. Rabbi Willick has in his standard form that you could say, I'm selling my entire house with the exception of this one room, and that room is not included in the bedika, in the mechira, and make it a room that doesn't have much chametz in it anyway. Make it like a bedroom or something, and not like a 4-year-old's bedroom, a bedroom that doesn't have a lot of food in it typically. Something that's easy to do a bedikas chametz on, and you'll do the bedika in that room. You'll be able to be mekayim the mitzvah of bedikas chametz. That's as far as the house is concerned. Yeah.
It's a little off topic, but Rav Schechter explains that the reason why Mechiras Chametz is mutter, not a harama, that's usher, is because you're not circumventing the mitzvah of Tashbisu, because you still have a little bit that you're not selling.
Right.
So, but how would a Mechiras Yud Gimel work? does Rav Schechter hold on the Mechiras Yud Gimel?
No, we always leave everything out of whenever we do a Mechiras Yud Gimel. Oh, because you're saying you're circumventing the mitzvah of Bedikas Chametz. So first of all, it could be that you're not circumventing the mitzvah of Bedikas Chametz, because, like we just said, you're leaving a room to do Bedika on. And even if you don't, let's get to the next point. At the hotel, it could be that you have a Chiyuv Bedika anyway. It's just that you won't have a Chiyuv Bedika on all of your properties, on all of the places. You'll only have a Chiyuv Bedika in the hotel room. So let's talk about that hotel room. So you do have to do Bedika in a hotel room on the night of Erev Pesach, if you're there already. There is some discussion. I saw someone to suggest that maybe you shouldn't have a chiyuv bedika because it's a makom shei machnisim bo chametz, because it's already before you ever took possession of it, they sent housekeeping in and they cleaned out the whole place. And housekeeping does a very good job in hotels of cleaning out the whole place, and therefore it's not going to require bedika. That is not true. I don't think that's correct. Bichlal. First of all, they don't do such a great job always. On an airplane, let's say they're supposed to clean out the whole airplane before they switch flights from before the next group of passengers goes on the plane. My wife and I got on a plane in Tel Aviv on Sunday night. My wife picks up the pillow from her seat, and in between the pillow and the cover, maybe it was under the cover, there was a pair of, I kid you not, a pair of underwear on her seat, and she's like, they don't always do such a great job of cleaning out the, she went to the flight attendant and said, there is underwear on my seat. Then the flight attendant said, there is what on your seat? And she wrapped her hand in like 15 million paper towels and removed the underwear and whatever and said, here, you can have a seat. Thank you so much. Okay, so the hotel staff is not known to do such a great job. Plus, but more fundamentally, even if they are the greatest staff in the world and they're super duper clean, they're not looking for chametz. They're not trying to clean it for chametz. They're trying to make sure that the room looks nice and the towels are fresh and that you have the body lotion and the shampoo. And they're not looking for chametz. In fact, many hotel rooms come with a feature called chametz. They come with something, some crackers or something that to make the guests feel comfortable. So it is certainly something. Very often they'll have alcoholic beverages in the room or something like that. So certainly, even if they clean the room well, they don't clean it for chametz. So it would seem clear that you would have to do bedikas chametz at the hotel. Now, at hotel programs, they do sometimes clean the room for chametz, meaning if you're at a hotel program where the program doesn't want people showing up and finding chametz, one could make that argument a little bit more cogently, but still, people bring in some chametz for breakfast on Erev Pesach into their own rooms, or chametz from their home bedika to burn, and once it becomes makom shemechnisim b'chametz, that's it. It's chayiv in bedika, meaning if it's a place that you bring chametz, even if you have all the chametz that you brought in accounted for, it's chayiv in bedikas chametz at the shas bedikas chametz. The obligation to do bedikas chametz in a new place of residence, in a place where you are moving to, really hinges on the understanding of why it is that we do bedikas chametz in a shul or a beis medrash. I saw this pointed out. Someone pointed out that the Shulchan Aruch HaRav in the Taf Lamed Gimel Os Lamed Vav and the Mishnah Brura Taf Lamed Gimel Sivkat Mem Gimel Paskin that when you do bedikas chametz in a shul or a beis medrash, you do say a bracha on the bedika. Meaning, typically, what they'll do is in a shul or a beis medrash, the rabbi, let's say, will do bedika in his house, and on that same bracha, he'll then go to the shul and continue to do the bedikas chametz there. And that seems to indicate that bedikas chametz in a shul is part of the original obligation, the original takana of bedikas chametz, and therefore requires a bracha. A shul or a beis medrash doesn't belong to any given individual. So chametz that's in a public place like that doesn't belong to any specific person. So why is it that there's a requirement of bedikas chametz? So the answer to that question is going to help us understand the hotels a little bit better. The Aruch HaShulchan in Taf Lamed Gimel Os Yud Beis explains why is it that you have to do bedikas chametz in a shul if the chametz there doesn't belong to any particular individual, and he says it must be based on shitas hatosfos. Why is it that we do bedikas chametz at all? So Rashi says, so shelo yavar lov bibal yirah bal yimatze, that you shouldn't come to violate bal yirah bal yimatze. So you'll avoid the issue of owning the chametz. I don't own the chametz anyway. It belongs to the community or to nobody or to or whatever, it's just around the shul. But Tosa says, no, the reason for Bedikas Chametz is Shema Yavali Achlo, that you might come to eat the Chametz. So even though the Chametz might not be owned by somebody, there's still a concern of Shema Yavali Achlo, so you do Bedikah with a Bracha based on Shitas HaTosos. According to Rashi, L'chari, you should not make a Bracha. So if the reason for Bedikas Chametz is owning Chametz, there would be no Chiyuv of doing Bedikah in a hotel room either, because the contract in a hotel room is not that you now own the hotel room or that you're even renting the room. The contract is that they have to provide you with a place to stay, and this is the place that they are providing you with now. But if you walk in and you say, I have a problem with this, or they say, you know what, we need to do construction on this room or something, there's some issue there, we're moving you to a different room, you have no say. You have to be moved to a different room. Just this past Shabbos, I was in a hotel. My wife and I showed up on Thursday in a beautiful hotel in Yerushalayim, and we walked into the room, and there were 1,000 bugs flying in the air in the room. I didn't count if it was exactly 1,000, but in that ballpark, I'm not exaggerating, all over the room. So we called up front desk, and they said, we'll send somebody, and the guy came, and he said, I could spray it. We're like, and then what? You know, then we'll like live and spray. So they moved us to a different room, and that's part of the contract. That's we weren't renting that room. We weren't renting anything. Someone else was paying for it, but they weren't renting that room. They were paying for the right to for the hotel to accommodate us. That has nafkaminas for Ilchus Erevin, by the way, also, because if there are multiple rishuyos that each person is considered to be the separate balabas on, then you need an Erev Chatzeros in order to carry even in the hallways of the hotel. But if it's all considered to belong to the hotel owners and they just have a lot of guests, they have a lot of people who are staying in their hotel who they can move around as they please, then you probably don't need an Erev Chatzeros in order to be carry in the halls of the hotel. So some poskim, based on this idea, paskin that you should not say a bracha when you do bedikas chametz in a hotel. However, if the reason that we do bedikas chametz is the concern that you might eat chametz, then the chari, you should say a bracha bedikas chametz in a hotel, because there's a concern that you might come to eat the chametz in a hotel that you're staying in, if there's going to be chametz in that hotel room. Rav Vosner in Shevet HaLevi, Chelek Aleph Sim Kuf Lamed Hey, gives a different explanation of why we do bedikas chametz in shul, and that also affects our discussion of the hotel. Meaning, even though according to Rashi, the original reason for the chiyuv of bedikas chametz is shlo yavar lev bal yirah bayimatzei, Chazal, based upon that concern of shlo yavar lev bal yirah bayimatzei, made a chiyuv bedika, we're misakin the chiyuv bedika for anybody who has the right to use that property. Meaning that was, there's the motivation for the takanas bedikas chametz, and then there's the actual mechanism of the takana, the actual rules of the takana. The motivation might have been shelo yavar lev bal yirah bayimatzei, but the mechanism of the takana was that anyone who's using a property should do bedika on that property, regardless of whether you own the property or not. So based on that, Rav Vosner writes in Chelek Yud, Simen Samach Ches, that a bracha should be said when you do bedikas chametz in a hotel, because regardless of who is the rightful owner of it, even according to Shitas Rashi, you would need a bracha. And then you throw in Shitas HaTosos, which of course would say you need a bracha. So Mishra Brura paskins that a bracha is said when you do bedikah on a shul or a beis medrash, which sounds like he must agree with one of these reasons, and therefore lechora a hotel is going to be the same, either because we pass like Tosos and the concern is Shem Yavol Le'achlo and you have to bedikah, or even though we pass like Rashi, the nature of the takana is if you have the right to use that property, then you should be reciting a bracha on the bedikah. And this is what a number of the contemporary poskim assume. That's what they quote from Rav Eliashiv and others. Now, I do have to mention that I did not speak this over with our poskim. I wanted to catch Rav Shechter and Rav Willig this morning and just sort of run through the list of 10 questions, of which we've done one so far. I'll try to move a little more quickly in the next 9, but just sort of make sure that I get the psak of our yeshiva. I'm just telling you what Hanir Lanias Daiti, without yet consulting with Rav Shechter Rav Willig, or asking Rav Shechter Rav Willig, Bez Hashem, when I do, I will change to whatever they say. Yeah.
What if somebody wants to go to a hotel for the last day is...
Shaila number two. Shaila number two. What if you go to a hotel on Pesach? Thank you for that segue. That's fantastic. Or what's coming up a lot this year, because there's a Geshmak HaChalamoed, because there's Pesach falls on Shabbos, a lot of people are going to Airbnbs for Chalamoed. Someone in my shul told me he's renting a place in the Hamptons for Chalamoed. Someone else told me they're renting a place in North Carolina for Chalamoed. That someone else happens to be my wife, and apparently I'm going there too. So if you're going to go into an Airbnb, and an Airbnb they could have all sorts of chametz all over the place when you show up. You don't know what the situation is. Some of these places are places where people actually live, and they realize that if they move out for a little bit, they can make money. Although that's not typical. Most of these are investment properties, and but sometimes just to make it more homey, they'll provide chametz for you in the cabinets or something, so you could have what to eat when you come after a long journey. So the question is: so if I show up to a place that has chametz in the cabinets, so first of all, do I have to do b'dikas chametz when I get there? And second of all, what do I do with all that chametz? Yeah. So no, if there was a Jew who was in control of the rooms already at that time, and Erev Pesach Dev, meaning like the program, it's probably their responsibility. But if there's a legitimate concern, you should probably do bedika, just not with a bracha. You wouldn't do with a bracha anyway at that point. So you do bedika without a bracha on Erev Pesach the day of. Now, so you go to the Airbnb. So the first thing is, before you come into the room, you should probably say to yourself, I am having zero kavana whatsoever to acquire any of this chametz with a kinyan chatzar or anything else. They can't force me to be kona chametz, even if they're trying to be nice to me by leaving chametz for me. So I have no das whatsoever to be kona chametz. And then as soon as you get inside, you should check the whole space for chametz. You should do a b'dikas chametz, because any place that you're going to be needs to be checked for chametz. Even if it's not your chametz, you still have to be concerned shem yavo li achlo. So as soon as you get into the hotel or the Airbnb, you should check the room, the fridge, anything for chametz. As far as kashering, which a lot of people ask about also, because I'm renting an Airbnb for 3 days, I may want to cook something. So the rules of kashering for Pesach are that whenever you're doing Haggadah, that kashering has to be done before Pesach, before the Isra of chametz. Whereas Libun, if you're able to do Libun, then you could do that even on Pesach, because Haggadah and Libun work in different ways. Libun works by burning out and destroying any tam of chametz that might be in the kelim, whereas Haggadah works by drawing it out into the water that you're doing the Haggadah in. By drawing it out, it relies on bittul. Chametz asur mashu, you're not going to have bittul, whereas Libun you can actually do. There are very few things that we do Libun on. Self-cleaning oven is Libun. Other than that, you should not be using blowtorches and trying to do things like that. You're going to burn down the whole Airbnb. It's not a good idea. Even self-cleaning ovens, most of the time these days, it breaks the oven when they self-clean. It's I like to refer to it, it's not a self-clean feature, it's a self-destruct feature. Every year I get people calling, you told me to self-clean my oven, now my oven is broken. It's not my fault the oven company built a self-destruct feature in the oven. Yeah, so someone said, so last year their oven broke, so this year they decided they're just going to kasher by turning it on to the highest for an hour after not using it for 24 hours, a libum kal. And they said that also broke their oven. Okay, so things are not made the way they used to be. Third Shaila. Yes?
All right, would it be lechatchila to call in advance and have them get a chametz for you or something like that? Or have the shabbat?
You could certainly ask them to, but you would still have to do b'dikas chametz. Meaning whoever they are is whoever owns the Airbnb is probably not a Jew anyway. If you had a shliach who's a Jew who knows what they're looking for, then you can do that also. Now, third Shaila, a lot of people own pets, and every year at the Mechiras Chametz, it used to be John Brown, of blessed memory, used to always be kind enough to, you know the story of John Brown. John Brown was Rabbi Willig's guy for 40-something years. He was the one that, he's like a legend in our community, and And he would say every year, my daddy died when he was like 45 years old. My granddaddy died when they were like coal miners or something. So John Brown said, John Brown retired when he was like 50, assuming, and moved somewhere upstate, just assuming he was going to die. He went to go die somewhere upstate. And he lived well into his 80s. And each year he said, I lived this long in the merit of the fact that I do this mitzvah of buying all this chametz. Then COVID hit. And he couldn't come back into the city, and he did not buy the chametz that year, and that year he died. So who's to say that he was wrong? Maybe that was his chus. But anyway, so why was I talking about John Brown? Oh yeah, so John Brown used to buy a lot of pets. People would come and they would sell everyone's dogs and everyone's fish and everything. So what's the story with that? A lot of times pets need to eat chametz. For whatever reason, their diets cannot change so easily. And if that's the case, what do you do about that? You're not allowed to get any hana'ah from chametz. So if you're feeding, anybody is feeding your dog chametz, you're getting hana'ah from that. So even if you're feeding someone else's dog chametz, that's also hana'ah, because you get hana'ah from the fact that you're providing food for an animal. So you're not allowed to get any hana'ah from the chametz. So what does one do about a dog? So one of these suggestions is, Mishbur writes in Taf Memches Sifkatan Lamed Gimel, is to sell the pet and have the nachri come feed the pet. So you shouldn't be doing the feeding, and you shouldn't. You shouldn't own the pet anymore. The Aruch HaShulchan says much better for the Nachri to actually take possession of the pet, not just to buy it on the books, but to actually give it to a kennel that where you're selling the pet to them. Or maybe even better, because Mishmur thinks it is too much of a harama to sell the pet and the food to the same Nachri. That's already a harama. I'm selling you my dog, and I'm selling you my dog food. Now please give my dog food to your dog food, wink, to your dog. Now maybe a better idea would be to sell sell the pet to one Nachri, sell the pet food to a different Nachri, and have one Nachri feed the other Nachri's dog with his own dog food. So that's pretty easy to do, actually, because if you include the dog in your mechira, so the dog will be sold, leave the dog food out of your mechira, and then give that dog food to the kennel where you're keeping your dog. Oh, is that what it's called, a kennel? I don't know, wherever people keep dogs for a week, wherever the babysitter. So you say, Matana Gemura, I don't want this bag of food back. This is yours, and I never want to see it again. Right? So now it belongs to them, and they can go and feed that chametz to the dog that belongs to whatever the modern-day equivalent of John Brown is. It was Rabbi Willig found a new guy last year, but he won't do it this year because it's Good Friday or something. I mean, he's a very religious person, so he wouldn't do it. So now he had to find yet another person to engage. Shaila number four. Better yet would be sell the dog permanently and never take it back. Yes, correct. Agreed. You said better yet to run it over with your car? That's horrible. You shouldn't say something like that. Don't say that. Yeah.
Just to clarify, people give their pets away for the week to someone else. Is that still available?
People, yeah, they'll give away their dog for the week. Now, if you have fish, I find you could drop bloodworms in there, and the fish sometimes will eat it and sometimes will die, but then you can buy new fish. So, you know, if they're willing to eat the bloodworms, you know, that's okay. Bloodworms are not chametz. They're a little bit gross, but, you know, that's what you got to do, if that's what you got to do. So, fish will often also eat other, you know, like you could drop in a block of salmon or something, and they'll eat that. Also, fish don't need to eat very much. Usually, if you don't feed fish for a week, they'll be fine. I mean, I'm not taking responsibility for all your dead fish, but yeah.
Is there a luck way to keep a dog in the house?
So you'd have to have, first of all, to feed it non-chametz. You can feed a kidney, so you can get hana from kidneys. And there is a list of dog foods that are non-chametz. I think the CRC has a list of, so that would be the best thing to do. Then you have no shilas whatsoever. I'm saying if the dog, for whatever reason, is such a picky eater that he needs to eat chametz, so then you have that issue. Okay, what if I'm gluten-free? What can I do about matzah? So that is a very common shaila nowadays because everybody seems to be going gluten-free. Either people have legitimate allergies or just stam on a health kick or whatever. So there are five grains that are identified in the Mishnah. Those five grains are the only things that are chayiv and chalan, the only things that you mivarech alav motzi lechem min ha'aretz, and the only things that can become chametz, and the only things from which you can make matzah. Typically speaking, we have always translated one of the grains as being oats. However, it is very questionable whether that is in fact the case, whether oats are in fact a grain or merely a vegetable. Rav Shechter seems to be of the belief that oats are not a grain, and therefore one is better off not having oat matzah. He pointed out that if you have oats from America or from Israel, so oats have been growing next to wheat for so long that they've taken on certain wheat properties, and they therefore may be a grain already, but they also won't help you if you're gluten-free. So most of the oats that they make for gluten-free people come from England, where the oats have been growing separately from wheat for a long, long time, and therefore they are in fact gluten-free, but they are also in fact not a grain. So if your only option as a gluten-free person is oat matzah, because you don't want to be you don't want to get sick, if you're not going to get sick and you just have a hang-up about it, so get over your hang-up or whatever, but if you don't want to get sick from eating the regular matzahs, so probably you could rely on those poskim that hold that oats are in fact a grain and eat oat matzah, but I would at least suggest listen to someone else's bracha. And instead of making a bracha, so it definitely be machmir to eat a kazayas of the oat matzah, but better to listen to someone else's bracha if there's going to be someone else at the table that's eating wheat matzah, that you can say a bracha. Does spelt work for gluten-free people? They have spelt matzahs now.
For some.
Okay. So if spelt works and that's a grain, that would be a better option than oats. Okay. So that's as far as gluten-free. Shaila number five, I think we're up to. A diabetic and dalid kosos. Or anyone who just gets sick from wine and dalid kosos. So when it comes, so first of all, it's important to realize that you probably don't have to drink as much as you think you have to drink. Meaning especially for a diabetic, for someone who's going to be very ill, even though the Gemara tells us, I forgot who it was, that drank dalid kosos and was sick until Shavuos, you don't necessarily have to get yourself sick until Shavuos in order to do the mitzvos halayla. So the minimum size of a kos for dinim derabbanan is probably under 4 ounces, 3 point something, let's say 3.8 or something like that. And then you drink half of that as you're, for each kos. You're not talking about a great deal of drink. Furthermore, you can dilute the wine. You should not dilute the wine to the point where it gets to less than 4% alcohol, but you can dilute it to get to as low as 4.something% alcohol, as less than 5% alcohol. That's based on the cheshbon from the Gemara, the dilution rates that the Gemara had, where the Gemara assumed wine has a maximum, I think, of alcohol content you'll ever find in wine, something like 14%. I've got exactly how it works out. And they would dilute 4 parts to 1 part, and that would still be 4 parts water to 1 part wine, and it would still be called wine. So you see that. So we try to keep it 4% alcohol. If you're machmir that you need to have wine for dalid kosos. It used to be that they didn't have the option of grape juice, because grape juice, the time of the harvest is in Sukkot time. So if they would use those grapes at that time, if they would press those grapes at that time, of course it would ferment and turn to wine by the time you got to Pesach. They didn't have agents that would, or things to add that would prevent the fermentation process and prevent it from turning into wine. So since they didn't have the option of grape juice, the only time they ever had grape juice is if they drank it fresh. That's why the Gemara says in Maseches Bava Basra, I think it's Maseches Bava Basra, right? The Gemara says Sochir Adam an oven, that a person can squeeze the grapes and drink it like that, because that's grape juice that you could be Yotze Kiddush with, right? Grape juice, according to everybody, I'm not being clear. Let me back up a second. There is a shaila whether you can be yotzei kiddush with grape juice, whether grape juice has a din of wine. This is a major machlokas aposkim. It was Rabbi Rav Shechter likes to point out that Rabbi Louis Ginsburg from the JTS made a big stink about this at some point, where he said that grape juice is perfectly fine to use as for kiddush. A lot of other poskim disagreed. There were poskim that held like Rabbi Louis Ginsburg. Also, he was not, he was in the seminary. He was not Orthodox. He was not everyone. Some people in the seminary were Orthodox, but he was so whatever it was. So for some reason, the reason Rav Shechter likes to quote that is because it was really he was really mastering the Jewish community, because in the times of prohibition, you weren't allowed to have wine except for sacramental purposes. So the Jewish people are always able to make wine because we needed it for Kiddush. So he mastered that. No, you don't need it for Kiddush. Grape juice is just as good. Now, why would grape juice not be just as good? And why would it, yes, be just as good? So the Gemara says, in the Masechet Babas, V'socher ad manavim, you could squeeze grapes and use that for Kiddush. And you could be Mekadish, you'll have Kiddush Hayom when you squeeze grapes. So it says, Beferish, that you could use grape juice. It takes time for wine to ferment. So the Machlokas is, yeah, but at least that grape juice could have turned to wine. But what if you take grape juice and you do something to it to make it that it can't possibly turn to wine? So would that be kosher for Kiddush also? That's the machlokas haposkim, right? That's the discussion in poskim. If it can't turn to wine because you've done something to it. I remember I was once in the OU office and with Rav Shechter, and we got a call from someone who, a doctor from, I think from Efrat, from Israel, who works in the States and, you know, during the week and flies back to Israel for Shabbos. And she was stuck for Shabbos. Her flight got canceled. She was stuck in, I think it was like Omaha, Nebraska or something for Shabbos. Or maybe, no, it was even Omaha, Nebraska, I think, has a Jewish community. She was stuck somewhere that didn't really have a Jewish community for Pesach. Right? The rabbi from Omaha sold his chametz to Warren Buffett a few years ago. That was a big story. You don't remember that? Okay, maybe it was before your time. I don't know. But there's the she was stuck. So, by the way, they're looking for an assistant rabbi in Omaha. If anyone is interested, let me know. I have to get back to them. But she was stuck somewhere far away, and she didn't have any grape juice. And she found like she found one little bottle of grape juice enough for one cup, and she had challah roll. So her shaila was, when do I use the grape juice? Kiddush night, day, Havdalah, make Kiddush on bread Friday night, what do I do? So Rav Shechter said, tell her to go to the store and buy a bunch of grapes and squeeze them and make grape juice. So like, I'm like, you know, as soon as he said that, I'm like, what a strange thing to say. Like, you know, like, who would think like that? But then I realized, it's a Gemara. It's exactly what the Gemara says. He was just thinking what the Gemara said. Gemara says, and Mekadish, love Kiddush Hayom, that you squeeze grapes and you make Kiddush. So anyway, so there is a Machlokas HaPoskim, whether grape juice is good for Kiddush. We Paskin, the generally accepted practice, is that it is good for Kiddush. However, on the night of the Seder, it's a little trickier, because the Gemara has this expression, Yidayayin Yatzi Yidei Cheirus Lo Yatza, and there's a mitzvah of Cheirus and Simcha, and all of that. So does that play a role, and maybe require that it have some alcohol content to it? So Rav David Feinstein, Zichrono Livracha, held that it does need to have some alcohol content to it. Rav Shechter is Machmir, that it should have alcohol content to it. Rav Asher Weiss thinks, even L'chadchila Shabbat L'chadchila, it's perfectly fine to use grape juice. So if wine hurts you, you certainly have many poskim, including Rav Asher Weiss, to rely on. That's not going to help a diabetic, because grape juice is still full of sugar, so it's not going to help a diabetic. So what they may want to consider is how much can they get away with, meaning can they, if they could drink 1.5 fluid ounces diluted 4 times, so then it may be beneficial to them, meaning they could use I once did the math on this of how, like, at the end of the day, they can make a mixture of 40% wine, 60% water. So then it will knock it down to, let's say you have a wine that's 10% alcohol. So you mix 40% wine, 60% water, that will knock it down to 4% alcohol. And then you have 1.5 fluid ounces each cup. So each time you're having, like, what was, you know, 40% of 1.5 fluid ounces. Someone want to do the math on that? What? 0.6 ounces. And you do that four times. So what are you having? 2.5 ounces of wine? So if you can handle that, so maybe that's better to do. Otherwise, you may have to use tea. Meaning if a person can't even handle that, then maybe they'll have to use tea. Chamar Medina, which is certainly not ideal for the Seder night.
You could do that question on Yom Tov, or it has to be done before? Like the deadly.
Oh, because of the measuring, you're saying? If you're measuring exactly, so it's a Medida L'Tzorach Mitzvah.
Interesting. Is
that considered L'Tzorach Mitzvah? Or it's L'Tzorach Challah? You shouldn't get sick. One or the other. Or both. Yeah. Okay, bring it all together. Shaila number six. A lot of people are emailing. Maybe I just get the shaila because I wrote an article about coffee, but everyone's asking me if they need a new coffee machine and a bean grinder and all these fancy things. I wrote an article about coffee. I'm not such a coffee snob. I don't really, you know, I don't have a special bean grinder on my counter or anything else. But anyway, meaning people say I'm a purist. I would never put a flavored bean anywhere near my coffee machine. I'm a purist. I drink good coffee. I'm not some sort of pig off the street that's going to drink like French vanilla or something, right? So I know that that it's only at regular plain roasted coffee beans. So given that, do you need to kasher for Pesach? So there is a minhag that anything that's left out on the counter, any kli that's left out on the chametz counter throughout the whole year, there is a minhag to kasher such things. However, I think that minhag only applies to things that could be used accidentally for chametz, or chametz could get inside of it. A coffee machine is a very self-contained thing. It's not like this open, if you leave a food processor out, and the food processor, you say, oh, I only used it for non-chametz items. Yeah, but there's chametz flying all around your kitchen, and you wash it in the same sink and everything else. So that, for sure, you would need to kasher. But if you a coffee machine, you could probably just wipe down the outside. You could run it through to kasher it. I think that's what the OU recommends. Run it through with water to kasher it. Kabbalah kachpolto, and just clean it off really well, and that would be fine. And the same would be true with the bean grinding implement as well. The OU says about the Keurig that even though unflavored coffee grounds are always kosher l'Pesach, since a Keurig takes cups, K-cups that are not kosher l'Pesach, and people might use that, so they say you should kosher the machine. But if you know that you would never put a flavored coffee pod into your coffee machine, then the Chorid shouldn't even need that. But aside from whether you're allowed to kasher plastic for Pesach, most of the Keurig is plastic, which is probably why it doesn't require tefillah's kelim, among other reasons why it doesn't require tefillah's kelim. The OU allows kashering plastic b'makom tzorich. Rav Shechter allows b'makom tzorich. This comes up with kashering dishwashers, which, by the way, is another major shaila that people have. And Rav Shechter's answer is a little bit difficult because every dishwasher has plastic components. Usually the racks are plastic, even if the body of the dishwasher is metal. So Rav Shechter always says, if there's a tzorich, if there's a major tzorich, we can kasher plastic. So what's a tzorich? So if you're having a lot of company and you don't have help to wash the dishes, meaning it's going to be on the whoever's running the kitchen in that household who's going to be is going to end up having to wash the dishes multiple times over and over and over again without the help of a dishwasher, and they're already plotzing, so that might be good. That Rav Shechter has said is considered a makom tzorech. But if you hire help to wash the dishes to make it a little more convenient for them, or that you're paying them whatever $15 an hour, and now you're going to save $15 by paying them for one less hour, even that probably is not considered a makom tzorech. So anyway, the Magen Avraham says that narrow tubes that can't be scrubbed clean shouldn't be kasher for Pesach. The Magen Avraham, Tafnun Beisiv Katan Yod Aleph. So the OU does kasher pipes and other inaccessible areas for Pesach productions of things, but that's because all the production happens before Pesach, where it's batel b'shishim. So the chumrah of the Magen Avraham is on Pesach, when even a mashu of chametz would make everything aser. However, there are those that suggest if you use a davar apogim, it's even better. But again, I think it's really not necessary. You just run through the Keurig machine once or twice with water, and that should kasher, and that should be fine if you've never used it for chametz. If you've used it for chametz, then you do have to take the kashering a little more seriously. You should probably take out the plastic piece that holds the pods and do agala on that separately. That comes out pretty easily. Do agala on that separately and run it through with some sort of dabra pogame as well. Was there a question? Another question. Question number 7. We'll make it. We're doing good now. Question number 7. Can you kasher a sous vide for Pesach? So what is a sous vide machine? Show of hands if you know what a sous vide machine is. What? Yes, it has now become a very common question. Every rabbi is getting this question now. Can you kasher a sous vide for Pesach?
Because people don't roast the meat.
So people, first of all, it's ideal for the Seder night in that sense, right? Because it's not roasted. And also just because people like it. It's whatever. That's the shtick that people enjoy making things with a sous vide. So can you kasher for Pesach? So strictly speaking, if you're using it properly, it should have never come in contact with chametz, right? Meaning the whole idea is that the food that you're cooking is completely vacuum-packed in plastic. And that plastic bag of meat or chicken is sitting in this pot of water, and then the sous vide machine, the sous vide wand, sits in the water also and heats up the water to whatever, some very low temperature, 130 degrees or something like that, or whatever you set it to, and it moves the water around the pot, to keep it a consistent temperature. However, a kitchen is a kitchen, and things happen. Things rupture and break and tear open, and sometimes the machine does come in contact with whatever the contents of the bag are. In addition to that, it's being cooked in a chametz kitchen the whole year round. So l'chora, it should require kashering for Pesach. However, it's not so pasha to kasher for Pesach, because one of the basics of kashering, certainly when you're doing hag'alah, is that you first need to clean it. If the item cannot get perfectly clean, then you cannot do hag'alah on it. In addition to that, the Mishnah Brura in Tafnun Beis, if Katan Lamed Aleph, says that if there are these tiny cracks and crevices where it would be impossible to really clean, if something got stuck there, even if you don't see anything stuck there, there's a minute we don't kasher such things. We don't kasher anything that has tiny cracks and crevices that cannot cannot be cleaned out properly. And that's why, for example, if you kasher your sink, but you have a sink rack with like a metal grate that goes back, or let's even better, the mesh drain stop, right? That also should just be removed. It should not be kashered because it's got these tiny cracks and crevices, and we assume that you can't kasher something with tiny cracks and crevices. Now, the sous vide has a fan mechanism that keeps the water moving around at a consistent temperature in the pot. So it has these little holes in it in order to move the water around properly. So that, the OU policy, if I'm not mistaken, is, in fact, I'm not mistaken, I have it right in front of me, the OU policy is not to kasher a sous vide machine. They write, regarding kashering a sous vide machine, there are two parts to the apparatus, the water bath, meaning the pot, and the heating element, what we would call the wand. One may not kasher utensil unless all sections are accessible and it can be scrubbed clean. Since the heating mechanism has a fan and narrow areas that are difficult to access, it should not be kashered. The pot can be kashered, like you would kasher any pot, but, there's no value in that, meaning you could use any pot also for a sous vide. I don't know if you need to use a particular pot in order to make sous vide stuff, sous vide food on Pesach. Number 8. Any questions? So far so good? Okay. Number 8. People will call you up and they will say, I have a counter made of lava or resin. Or like, they'll just say words, and and you're like, I don't know what that is. I know what a kli chares is. I know what matachas is. I know what. So can I kasher my counter? It's made of these different items. So corian, quartz, things like that. So it is important. First of all, just in general, I should have mentioned at the beginning, the most common Pesach questions are, Rabbi, is this product okay for Pesach? meaning like they'll send you a picture of a of some sort of medication or a children's medication or an antacid or something like that. Is this okay for Pesach? Does it have any chametz? Those are the most common Pesach questions. In that, you just have to, if you're a rabbi, you just have to become proficient at Google. What I mean by proficient at Google is that you have to know how to find it online and how to find it from a reputable source. So you just have to make sure that you're finding from the OU, the OK, the Star K, the CRC, the Chav K. You know, make sure you're finding from a reputable source. You don't know, most rabbis, I can say for myself at least, don't know any more than the person asking the question. It's just that they have confidence in my Googling skills or my ability to use apps. That's the most common question. But again, that's not really a shaila. That's just a matter of finding the. But one of the resources that's out there is I believe it's the OK website. I think CRC has it also. A whole list of all the different things that countertops can be made of and what their status is. So. The countertops either have to be kosher or covered for Pesach. If you're going to cover them, you should cover them with something that's impenetrable, meaning not something that's porous, something that's non-porous. In fact, they now sell, I just saw this advertised, they now sell like this this countertop cover that looks like a marble countertop. So you can upgrade your kitchen in the way it looks. Instead of your kitchen looking like a spaceship with everything covered in silver foil, your kitchen could look like it has the most updated fancy marble countertops. The procedure for countering for kashering countertops is iroi mayim roschin. You pour boiling water and you ideally use a kashel pesach pot. If you want to use a chametz pot, then don't use it for 24 hours in advance. And you just make sure you hit every spot of the countertop. Much easier to cover it than it is to kasher it. So you can kasher a stone countertop. That's permissible. So, for example, a marble countertop, provided that it's smooth, can be koshered. A granite countertop can be koshered. A formica countertop, which is less and less common these days, is plastic. So that would depend on whether plastic can be kashered or not. So that Shachter thought only be makom atzorech. I don't think a countertop is a major makom atzorech. You could just cover it up. So probably should not be kashered. If wood is smooth, you can kasher for Pesach. Ceramic tile cannot be kashered for Pesach. So all of these things, you have porcelain can't be kashered. Concrete, people have concrete countertops, you can't kasher, it's very porous, so it's not able to be kashered for Pesach. Stainless steel, I don't think some people have stainless steel like in a more industrial setting, like a stainless steel countertop, that certainly can be kashered for Pesach. Caesar stone is a very common question. I think the minhag of poskim nowadays to be mekel on that, that even though it's like, I think it's a fake stone, I think they have these artificial things that are meant to mimic the real stone. The most common question you get about countertop stone, this is shayla number 9, is can you kasher with a steamer? Instead of pouring boiling hot water all over my counters, I would just rather steam the counter. They sell steamers all over the place. You go to Bed Bath & Beyond for $100, you get a steamer, and you just run the steam up and down the countertop. So does that work? So the general rule, Rav Moshe writes in Yerodeich, El-Galv Simon Samach, is that you have to kasher with water in liquid form. You can't kasher with steam. So a steamer can only be used for kashering if you meet two criteria. First of all, the steam has to condense to the point where the whole area that you're kashering is actually wet with water. It's actually covered in water, where it's not just like a thin layer of steam. You left it there long enough that it actually some water developed there. And secondly, the water has to be boiling. It has to be 212 degrees. The thing with steam is that it's so I don't know what the word I'm looking for is. It's so fine or non-mamashistic. I don't know, I can't think of a better word, that it immediately loses a lot of its temperature. Meaning even if it's very hot in the steam machine, by the time it hits the counter, it's already not so hot. So most steamers that they sell for for cleaning out cracks in between your counter and in between your tiles and things like that, do not fit that criteria. So what some people do is they'll pour a small amount of hot water on the counter, and then they'll use an iron. They'll take an iron that they would iron their clothing with, and iron the countertop, and that will heat up the water that's on the countertop, and it will get to 212 degrees. It will also break your counter, so you'll get an extra bonus. In addition, you'll have kosher broken counters. So you could try that, but at your own risk. That's probably even a chumrah, because that probably accomplishes Evan Malubim, right? Rabelski was machmir that when you kosher your countertop, it's not good enough to pour hot water. You need to have an Evan Malubim, that boiling hot stone that you've heated up going over the water as well. So the iron would accomplish that, but again, it will also break your counter, and it's also somewhat dangerous. There is, the Star K website says that there is one professional grade model of steamer that works, a Tornado VS4 professional steam cleaner that gets hot enough, that's 212 degrees, and enough water builds up, and it works. It costs about $1,000 to buy it. So if a neighborhood wants to chip in together and all buy it and pass it around, you know, from home to home as they kosher their counters for Pesach, I suppose they can do that, and that can work. But otherwise, koshering with steam is not recommended. It's not a great idea. The Shaila number 10. Taking pills. Are you allowed to take medication on Pesach when you know that the medication has chametz? So generally speaking, or that medication might have chametz in it, or might have kidneys in it, or you know that it has kidneys in it. So generally speaking, the halacha is, when it comes to kashrus, anything that's not roi la'achila, that's kol she'enu, the Gemara darshins in Masech Avodah Zarah, that you should give it l'gera asher b'sharecha, that a nevela should not be eaten. Instead, you sell it to you give it to a nachri or to an animal or something. So the Gemara darshins that nevela haruil l'gera is kriya nevela she'enu ruil l'gera is ena kriya nevela. That a nevela that's edible for human consumption is called not kosher. Is called nevela. Is called not kosher. But if it's inedible for human consumption, then it's automatically kosher. However, when it comes to chametz, we have a stricter standard. By chametz, it has to be not roi l'achilas kelev in order for it to be kosher l'pesach. And therefore, you have to, the most poskim assume that if you have chametz in a pill that is swallowed, if you ever try to chew on a pill that you're supposed to swallow, it is disgusting. It tastes terrible. If you would try to feed it to your dog, the dog would not enjoy eating that at all. It's not even roi l'achilas kelev. So since it's not roi l'achilas kelev, and you're not even having it derech achila, it would be mutter to have it on Pesach. For that reason, if your shampoo says, made with all five grains, you know, and water, fermented for 18 minutes or whatever, like you could say, you know, like glot chametz on your shampoo, but no dog in its right mind is going to eat your shampoo, it is permissible to use it on Pesach. For many, many years when I was growing up, and they still produced the book, there was a big Talmud Chacham in Far Rockaway by the name of Rabbi Blumenkrantz, Zichrono Livracha. When I first became a Rav in the Five Towns, he was still alive, and he would attend some of our Vod meetings sometimes, so I had the opportunity to meet him. He was a big tzaddik, a very, very special person. He also had many, many chumras, but he was the first one to introduce the concept of a Pesach book, you know, of like a list of what you can have and can't have. So he was the only show in town. The OU wasn't doing it, the Star K wasn't doing it, the CRC wasn't doing it, the OK wasn't. Nobody else was doing it. It was only Rabbi Blumenkrantz that was doing it. So the whole world assumed that whatever Rabbi Blumenkrantz held is the only shita. So when I was growing up, you had to check your shampoos, you had to check your perfumes, you had to check your soaps, you had to check your everything. You had to make sure your paper plates didn't have starch that connected it. You had to throw out your shaver because it's usher to shave. You had to everything had to go through what Rabbi Blumenkrantz said. So we later discovered that there are other poskim also that disagree with Rabbi Blumenkrantz. So one of the things Rabbi Blumenkrantz was machmir about is a chavis das that holds that even though nifsal me'achilas kelev is not called chametz, it's not a problem with chametz, that's only if it's nifsal me'achilas kelev. If you had chametz that was edible and then became spoiled and rotten to the point that it's no longer edible for a dog. But if it was made that way, milchanchila, if it was made that way on purpose, that they're making it as a shampoo and they're making it as a pill, that's not nifsal, and that therefore is chametz, and that's therefore going to be asur. Most of our poskim assume not that way, and therefore, if you have a pill that's going to be swallowed, we assume not roi l'achilas kelev and is therefore going to be mutter. So pretty much any medicine that an adult takes is not going to be a problem. Is not going to be a problem. However, if you have an equally effective thing, you know, pill without chametz, so you might as well be machmir if you can. If it's, but no need to go out of your way to be, you know, to be machmir, to use something that's suboptimal, you know, in order to be, or subpar rather, in order to be machmir. The bigger problem is with children's medications, because children's medications are chewables or things that you swallow. That is roi l'achila, and that, if it has chametz, is a real problem, and that's where the lists come in very handy. Toothpaste is a discussion also. Do you need to get only the kosher Pesach brand toothpaste? So this was a big discussion by Belsky and Rabbi Schechter. Belsky thought that toothpaste needed to be kosher in general. He thought that it's roi l'achilas adam. Rabbi Schechter holds that toothpaste is not only not roi l'achilas adam, it's not even roi l'achilas kelev. So they have very, very different opinions about toothpaste. Right? Belsky would always say, it tastes so pleasant. It has such a refreshing taste, toothpaste. Rabbi Schechter says, it may have a refreshing cleaning your mouth out kind of taste, but you would never eat it. No one would ever. I think Rav Shachter used to tell the Meister that someone asked Rav Soloveitchik. He said, "I fed my toothpaste to my dog, and my dog ate it." And he said, "You have a crazy dog." So that doesn't mean that it's Roi L'Achilas Kelev just because you have a crazy dog. So yeah. For that reason, I think it's probably fine. Any type of toothpaste is probably okay for Pesach. So that is the 10 most common shilas. Tomorrow, Bezer Hashem, if you want, you let me know if you want something else. I'm happy to do something else. But right now the plan is tomorrow we'll do the 10 most common Pesach questions. And then maybe Monday we'll do Agadah. Sunday we'll do something else. I don't know. We'll figure it out. Okay. One day is Haggadah and one day is 10 most. All right, let me know. Let me know what you want. I'm open.